The topic this morning was suggested by a member at the UU Congregation of the Chesapeake in Prince Frederick, where I filled the pulpit one day about 3 months ago. And there they have a congregational response, so you get to hear back ideas and thoughts. And the conversation drifted into the realm of ethics. And as one member tried to state her position, she sort of got stuck verbally, like we all, or at least I certainly sometimes do. And in her frustration, she just blurted out, "Well, what the hell is ethics anyway?" And we all laughed and we went on, but she set me to thinking. And this morning, I'd like to share with you some of those thoughts, primarily today about existential ethics, but also about non-existential ethics, which are both important. By ethics, I mean, as Karen was saying, the principles by which we determine right from wrong. Existential ethics, for me, would be I'm not talking about existentialist ethics or existentialist non-ethics. Existential ethics would be ethics relating to issues where our choice can spell the literal or virtual end of humanity. And non-existential ethics would be matters that are still of vital importance to us, to our sense of meaning and well-being. So by ethics, we're talking about principles, the principles we use to tell right from wrong. For example, of a good list of ethical principles, Karen just referred to one. We need look no further than the back of our order of service today. Our ethics are the directions, the north, south, east, and west on our moral compass. One of the watershed ethical experiences of my own life came about 25 years ago while I was doing my postdoc at Caltech. And one day I attended a talk by Dr. Richard Ernst, who had won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry about 10 years earlier. And here was Dr. Ernst speaking at Caltech in front of the faculty, administration, and students, receiving the Pauling Medal, which was named for Linus Pauling, in the Linus Pauling conference room in Gates Hall. And Linus Pauling, the person whose medal was the namesake of his, he had won Nobels in both chemistry and peace. And Dr. Ernst gave an acceptance speech that lasted about 2 hours. It was great. It changed my life. He is not a brash man. He's very mild-mannered. There have been two movies made about his life. You can find them listed on his Wikipedia page. He died in 2021. He's unassuming, and so by his mannerisms, it was a real surprise when, for the first 45 minutes or so, he broke all norms and measures of irony by telling us there in that setting, receiving that medal, how back in the early 1960s, the Caltech community had ostracized Dr. Linus Pauling for taking his stand against nuclear armament. In 1963, the local Pasadena newspaper, which is still a very conservative newspaper for Southern California, they quoted Caltech's president as saying, "What do I think of Dr. Pauling? I really just wish he would go away." Dr. Pauling was isolated there among the faculty. He eventually did resign his position that he had had there for 36 years, and for 4 years he could not get a job anywhere in academia. The great Dr. Pauling, who figured out everything basic about chemical bonding, who figured out the structure of the protein, who would have had the structure of DNA except for an elementary mistake by his graduate student that he didn't catch. For 4 years, he couldn't get a job anywhere, and only when anti-war politics became popular did he become hireable again. And in that talk, Dr. Ernst went on to use Dr. Pauling's story to make this point to those of us who were students and postdocs. He said, "Now, as you go out from here, take Dr. Pauling's life as an example. Consider what's right and what's wrong, and choose your projects, your research projects, and the companies you work for carefully. Science has not always been the driver of the ecological mess that the world is in today, but it has certainly been a willing co-conspirator along with consumerism and militarism and other isms in the game of creating that mess. He said, choose a field, a company, and research projects where you can at least, where you can repair the damage that we have caused, or at least a field where you can do no harm. And with my training, Dr. Ernst's talk left me with just a few directions for me to go. I chose, as a result of that talk, to go into biological sensors for two reasons. First of all, that work generally involves environmentally friendly chemistry. And secondly, it's really hard to make an offensive sensor. If you think about it, sensors are passive by nature, right? So that choice is what brought me to Maryland to work at Mesoscale Discovery for 15 years. And there I was privileged to play minor roles in developing two medical sensors that each directly benefited members of my own family. That choice also led Connie and me to move to New Market, moving up county, as many of us do. And from there, it was just a stone's throw to becoming a member at UUCF, where I would have probably never come without that connection. Questions like, what career direction do I want to take, are obviously important. They can apply to all of us because they are questions like, what volunteer work do I want to do? Where do I want to be of service in my church and in my community? To make the best life choices, we need to think about what's right and what's wrong, as Dr. Ernst urged us to do there at Caltech. Many issues of right and wrong, issues of ethics, are today paramount because they become existential issues, matters of life and death for all humanity. Humanity is now in an adolescent stage, with the ability to kill ourselves off and take a lot of life with us, but perhaps lacking the maturity and collective thoughtfulness yet to restrain ourselves from doing just that. We've got to make it through this adolescence, folks. The list of interconnected issues where humanity needs to make the right choices in order to survive is enough to make your head spin. There's human-caused climate change, overpopulation, environmental degradation and nuclear proliferation, rogue artificial intelligence, antibiotic resistance, social and political instability, and that's about a third of my list. I'm not going to go on, okay? At least, though, people, here's the part of the good news. More is coming later. People are working on all these problems. If you rate survival of our species as an important end, and that can be argued pro and con by philosophers, but most people would argue pro, then these are important existential problems to tackle as a career or in volunteer work or in activism today. William McCaskill has a book out that came out last year. What We Owe the Future is the title of the book. What We Owe the Future. He's a philosopher, young man. It's about choosing one's career or volunteer activities as an ethical choice. And he points out that people often choose a career because they focus on a problem that's close to their heart. I finally did that in my last career move. Before that, it was just whatever came up for me and looked good. But in my present career, that really close to my heart resonates with me now, because in my present career, I help people get jobs when they're experiencing barriers to employment. And it's probably no coincidence that when I was 25 years old, I had been homeless for 3 years, and somebody helped me get a job then, right? So perhaps I do what I do because I identify. But McCaskill suggests there are ways, systematic ways of thinking and choosing, by which we can systematically choose our careers or our venues for service by evaluating where our efforts would be most effective. And I'm not going to do a whole book report. He goes deep. It's a really good book. I do highly recommend this book to anybody who is considering a future career, a future vocation, or a vocational avocational move. To focus on the example, for a few moments of human-caused climate change. The good news, more good news, about existential ethics is that we're at least making progress in making ethical choices. The bottom line of CO2, atmospheric CO2 reduction, will come later. Last week, Al Gore pointed out in an interview that clean energy is cheaper now than ever. Electric vehicle sales are surging, and governments are subsidizing those sales. Gore said, "We know how to fix this problem. We can stop the temperatures from going up worldwide with as little as a 3-year time lag by reaching net zero. And if we stay at true net zero, half of the human cost CO2 will come out of the atmosphere in as little as 30 years. We can fix this, and we know how. The challenge, of course, is getting to net zero." In the same interview, Gore criticized oil and gas companies and rich countries, his words, for clinging to the veto power over language calling down for phasing down fossil fuels. He said the climate crisis is in the main a fossil fuel crisis. If the world is not permitted to discuss the phasing down of fossil fuels because a few companies and governments can veto that conversation, if they are not permitted to discuss phasing down fossil fuels because the fossil fuel companies don't want the world to discuss it, then that's a very flawed process, and we need to fix that process. If you're as old or older as I am, than I am, you may think that I've been speaking to the younger people in this room, but that's not the entire case. Just because you're my age or older is no reason to say, my time is past, he's talking to the young'uns, he's not talking to me. I'm not just disappointed. I'm silently angry when I hear people my age say things like, I'm glad I won't be around to see what's going to happen in the next 50 years. Maybe they're just being honest. Maybe they're just depressed about the state the world is in, and perhaps rightly so. I have some understanding of that, so I can conjure up some compassion. But you can count me in with Al Gore. I'm not ready to give up yet. One source of optimism, of an informed opinion that I've found that serves me, is the science fiction nonfiction of Kim Stanley Robinson. Now, you heard that right. He writes science fiction nonfiction. How can that be? It's science fiction because it's in the future, but not so far in the future that it becomes irrelevant. And it's nonfiction because Robinson goes to, this is a great idea, he goes to professional conferences where scientists and economists and psychologists and sociologists present their research. And people will like slip him ideas because they know who he is and what he's doing. And then he goes home and projects those ideas and those research projects that are going on into his writings, into the near future. And to stick with the example of solving human-caused climate change, because Robinson has focused on that topic for the last decade or so, I found myself reading his books thinking, that idea would never work. And then I've gone online and Googled it, and lo and behold, somebody's actually working on that very thing right now. There are a lot of really creative, plausible, fundable, and funded projects going on out there. Yes, the planet really can be saved, but only at a cost that we have so far been unwilling to pay. One of Robinson's books is The Ministry of the Future, and it follows the adventures of a group of UN bureaucrats. That sounds like really dry reading, but it's a great ride. These bureaucrats are charged with protecting the rights of future generations to inherit a livable Earth. If you stop for a minute and contrast Robinson's title, The Ministry of the Future, with McCaskill's What We Owe the Future, the similarity is no coincidence. Both Robinson's pragmatic, science-based, guarded optimism and McCaskill's practical call for the ethics of long-termism, as he calls it, those things both help me maintain my own optimism and keep me from giving up on the world. So keep the faith, as they say. The faith is defined by Unitarian theologian James Luther Adams, who wrote, "Faith is the certainty that we can solve all our problems together." The certainty that we can solve all our problems together. Those of you who qualify for what I hope will be the next greatest generation, you may not be keen to take up the mantle. For what it's worth, I acknowledge that my generation and the one before it failed to prevent global warming in the 1980s when we had a workable political coalition. The ball is largely in your court now. But my generation is not fully off the hook. To those of you my age and older, let us now serve as allies to the younger generations in the fight to preserve the earth for humanity and all living things. And to everybody here and online, use the principles and the methods of ethics to examine and re-examine your values and to make conscious choices about what issues you're going to work on for your remaining years. Never stop, never quit. Make your life count right up to the very last breath. And maintain a reasonable optimism coupled with commensurate actions at any age. I refuse to say I'm glad I won't be around to see the next 50 years. To the contrary, I wish I were going to be around so I could see how the next greatest generation is going to succeed. And I'm not saying that existential problems are the only ones worth working on. If you value meaning in life as experienced through the appreciation of beauty, then I say that is exactly what you should dedicate yourself to. In the process, I somehow expect you will dig down a bit to an ethical level of action like conservationism, if it's natural beauty that you're looking for, or if it's the fine arts, you might dig down to an ethical exercise of creative freedom through music or dance. I've had three professional careers. Been privileged to have three professional careers. I've gotten to do a lot of different stuff, and it's been fun. But none of those has explicitly addressed an existential problem, and that's okay. I have used ethics, however, to determine my directions, and to use ethics that way is at least a responsible thing to do. In the final analysis, our ethical principles are not the most important thing. The most important thing is whether we live out those principles. In seminary, I wrote an ethics paper where I disobeyed the directions from the instructor and I refused to choose between an ideal solution and a practical solution to an ethical dilemma. In my thesis, what became my thesis, which I defended over the course of a number of pages, was that it was neither the ideal answer nor the pragmatic answer that would satisfy fully. That the point of ethical striving may not be arbitrary results or perfection. The point might be the process of continued growth and change. As the song says, don't be afraid of some change. Interestingly, and to my surprise, the good professor gave me an A on the paper, and it was the only A I got in the class this whole semester. If that means there's any truth to my assertion that it was neither one or the other, the same truth is reflected by Emily Towns, the womanist theologian and ethicist. Towns wrote, if we are not changed by the religious and beliefs and the ethics that we take on, then when we lead others, we are hypocrites. She goes on to say, the greatest work is what we must do within ourselves and in our relationships with God and each other. Let us continue to do the ethical work that we need to do to choose wisely and to build meaningful lives so we can yet save ourselves, each other, our relationships, and this world. May it be so.